Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with choreographer Robert Moses about the world premiere of Trick Bags, Trap Doors, Painted Corners, created by Robert with guest choreographers Terrence Marling and LaTanya Tigner at Dance Mission Theater this weekend and next in San Francisco. From the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, I'll talk with conductor Ming Luke and guest tenor Brian Thorsett about upcoming performances of Dvorak's Stabat Mater at Hertz Hall on the Cal campus June 2nd through the 4th. Also stopping by is pianist Frederick Hodges, who is the featured guest artist with the California Pops Orchestra during their season finale at Cupertino's Flint Center coming up on Sunday, May 21st, entitled Best of the Pops. Also, regular contributor and critic at large Peter Robinson talks about cultural events around the Bay Area and previews Smut, An Unseemly Story by Alan Bennett. That's at the performing arts company Word for Word at Z Space through June 11th at Z Below here in San Francisco. Stay with us.
So, how do you feel now?
I feel betrayed, lied to, betrayed.
Some of the original music from PC Munoz and Terrence Marling, as well as my guest Robert Moses, for their work Trick Bags, Trap Doors, Painted Corners. Since founding Robert Moses Kin in 1995 in San Francisco, acclaimed choreographer Robert Moses has created numerous works of varying styles and genres for his highly praised dance company. His work explores topics ranging from oral traditions in African-American culture to the life and times and work of author James Baldwin, and the dark side of contemporary urban culture to the nuanced complexities of parentage and identity. Also, the simple joys of expressive power of pure movement. Having collaborated with fellow artists Margaret Jenkins and Alonzo King, among many others, and having choreographed for other institutions like the San Francisco Opera, Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, Jacob's Pillow, and Cincinnati and Oakland Ballets, Robert's latest collaboration is with LaTanya Tigner and Terrence Marling for the world premiere of Trick Bags, Trap Doors, Painted Corners, presented over these next two weekends at Dance Mission Theater here in San Francisco. Robert, welcome to Open Air. It's such an honor to have you in our studios.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, this is not going to be an evening of light entertainment, if what I'm reading is true. A frequent word to describe your work is provocative. Let me just read a description of Trick Bags, Trap Doors, Painted Corners. It's a look at how parents leave their children vulnerable, how literally dangerous it is for children of different heritages to be friends if they buy into the ideas of colorblindness and meritocracy. The trap doors refers to the issue of trust between parents. Trust the police, they shoot you. Trust your friends, they use inherited advantage. Trust your parents, they lie and tell you to believe in the American dream. Trust your parents, they say don't believe in the American dream, thereby betraying your dreams. Well,
wow! Wow, that sounds like that. That's an upbeat thing. Let's all go see that.
Well, what's interesting about that is that aren't we supposed to at this point be beyond all that?
No.
What happened?
Nothing happened. What happened is I think we're looking at each other again as human beings with everything that's going on currently. We have to really take a real look at what it means to share this world with each other, not to pretend like the differences we have don't make a difference, not to pretend like what's happening in the world isn't something that's going to not only affect us in the life that we have had, but affect those we're bringing into this world, and that others who bring folks into this world, those folks being children, have to face that as well, that my children who are African American will not necessarily have the same reaction from someone as someone else's children who aren't, because of who people believe they are, because of what they look like. That's what the piece is about.
Interesting. It sounds like that descriptive paragraph is exactly what we want to go towards. Is this, do you consider it more utopian and what we have now dystopian because of those idealistic beliefs?
Well, I don't know that we want to, I don't know that the idea of a utopia is a great thing at all. I mean, we're
never worked anyway.
No, it wouldn't work because we're human beings and we're flawed. And when you talk about a utopia, I think what you're talking about is erasing people to a certain extent, because if I want to live my life in one way and you want to live your life in another way, but the way you want to live your life is contrary to the way that I want to live my life, then there's no way we're going to get there. And that's fine as long as we make enough room for each other and we don't lie to each other about where we are.
So it's more than just an issue of tolerance,
it's not at all. It's not at all about tolerance. It's about preparation. The work is about preparation. If I prepare my children, and I mean that in the larger sense, for the world and the way I believe that it actually works, it means that it puts me in a conflicted place, right? I'm conflicted because of what you read. I'm conflicted because I want you to have the openness and the opportunity and the trust to approach others as if they have your best interests at heart. But sometimes we don't know what our motivations are. We don't know the baggage we carry with us. And that's part of what the work is about.
Mm-hmm. And do you see us going at some point beyond that? Would we want
No, we're not, because we're human beings. Look, we're human. And you pick a segment. That doesn't mean we don't get to a place where we're able to treat each other decently and with as much respect as possible. But at some point, we're going to come into conflict. We are. It's the way the world works. It doesn't mean that it's racist
or violent or
riddled with
differences.
Any of the isms. It's about the differences and making room. But you can't pretend like the isms and the ists don't exist.
Okay, so what? I know this isn't an easy answer then. What is the solution?
The solution is to continue forward and to be aptly prepared.
To be honest.
Honestly forward, right? And to prepare for life in a real way. To tell as much of the truth as you can without destroying the now, mm-hmm. right? If we're preparing children for the future, we want to give them as many tools as possible without burdening them with our own particular brand of blindness. And meaning, you know, when I was a child, you know, we were told, you know, you have to work three times as hard, you have to be twice as smart, you have to be able to ignore things. If something's in front of you, you have a few ways to deal with it. You can move it, you can go around it, or you can let it go through you.
Yeah, topics that our good friend W. Kamau Bell has brought up more than once.
Right, right. Okay. I mean, this was all kind of raised by all the things that happened in the last couple of years, where people began to talk publicly about the talk that, you know, African Americans have with their children. The truth is, we have a lot of talks with our children. It's not just, you know, watch out for the police, because it's not just that. There are a lot of things. If you look at African American literature, there's the older literature, some of the classic literature, there's almost always, you can read through everything, there's almost always a portion in the book where the protagonist finds out that they are black or African American or Negro. And that's about a shift in perception. That shift in perception is about not being the person who they thought they were in someone else's eye.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, taking a tangent away from this work for just a moment.
Sure.
I remember, you know, crying and at Barack Obama's inauguration.
Sure.
And did you see that as maybe something hopeful that would have changed things? But
that
instead,
is, you know, that's a fantastic example because people bring that up. And then what I do is I go a little further back and I say, I try to quote, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but Thurgood Marshall was asked about his appointment to the Supreme Court and what it meant for young black kids. And his quote went something like, they're not stupid. That's one job. So. It's fantastic that he's there. It's fantastic that he's an example. But that's one job. And that's it's one man with some extraordinary gifts and an ability to be tolerated, a skill. He's kind of like, it's a bit like Sidney Poitier, that is really palatable in a particular way. And there are those of us who aren't so much.
And to think that not necessarily that position, but now we have Clarence Thomas to look as to an example, maybe not so much.
Yeah, I'll let you go.
I'm not going to go there. Let's get back to artistry. Now, tell us about your association with Terrence Marling. How did you guys first collab?
Well, I called Terrence. I was looking for someone to do the work, and I called Arbor Street because Glenn Edderton, who is directing that company now, is a friend of mine from a few years ago when we were teaching in some of the same programs. And I said, I need a choreographer that's able to work with current events and willing to tackle some subject matter that may be difficult. And so he put me in contact with Terrence, and we hit it off, and he's doing the work. And then LaTanya, who is the featured artist on the Panther Project, which just, I think, closed in Oakland, is a fantastic artist who I've known for a number of years, and a fantastic person, said she would do this for me. And I said, thank you so much, because it really adds something else to the project.
What exactly are they adding to your vision of this?
What they're adding is their vision. It's not the point is that the work comes from the idea of perspective. The work comes from the idea of, if I'm coming from this place and you're coming from that place, what does it really look like? And what does it really mean to say these things or approach these ideas?
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to your core kin group of dancers, which are Norma Fong, Crystal Dawn Bell, Catherine Dissenhoff, Vincent Chavez, Byron Roman, and Dazan Solane, they'll be joined by 20 guest dancers of your ongoing Draft Project. What is the Draft Project? Tell us about that.
There are so many wonderful, wonderful dancers that are in San Francisco. And because most of us have small companies, most contemporary companies are between 6 and maybe 12 people. We go through years sometimes where if we're staying with the same artists, because we love those artists, performing artists, that we don't get to work with so many people, many of the people that come through town. And with this project, I get to at least once a year work with a number of the artists who are in town and maybe here for a year or so, without having them sort of see them come through and go away before I've had a chance to work with that palette.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of palette, is this a colorblind, body type blind casting that you have for Draft?
Draft itself is about the artist. It's there may be a subject matter we're using the draft artists to help us fulfill trap doors, but Draft itself is about the individual as the palette and as the thing that I'm using to create the work.
Mm-hmm. So how are you conveying these broader thoughts with your dancers on the stage?
That is a great question. That question is also framed this way: is how do you make dance that speaks to people in such a way that they'll understand it? The only answer I have to that is you have to come and see it, because if I translated it into words again, then it wouldn't make sense. It would turn into a textbook.
Well, speaking of seeing it, you can see the centerpiece performance at Dance Mission Theater, but there are also some street appearances that are going to be happening in the Bayview and at the Powell Street cable car terminus. Now, I'm assuming you had to get special permissions for this, unless it was a flash mob idea where they're just going to show up and do something.
Well, you know, we called the city and we said, what do we need? And the city said, unless you want to have a table and loudspeakers and all of these things, just go out there and do it with a battery operated boombox.
Wow.
And that's what we're doing.
It's good for our city.
It's not bad, right?
Yeah,
it's good.
So when are those live performances on the street?
Well, we've had the first two at Powell Street and at 3rd and Palou the last 2 weeks. And then we're going to have some moving into the summer, but the dates aren't set yet for those.
Okay. We heard a bit of your composing in the opening work. We're going to go out with something. You create some original scores for some of your works, including this one. This is in collaboration with PC Munoz and Terrence Marling.
Well, the two pieces that I think you have now are both PC.
And we'll hear PC singing on that one. Okay, well, Robert, we look forward to these performances. Once again, Dance Mission Theater is where the main events are happening this Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 4, the following weekend the same way. Dance Mission Theater is at 3316 24th Street, the corner of Mission here in San Francisco. More information at robertmoseskin.org. Robert, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
And good luck with that.
Thank you.
Who will bury me when I'm through burying children? Who will bury me when I'm through burying children? Who will bury me when I'm burying children? Who will bury me when I am through burying children?
PC Munoz singing part of that music that you'll hear as part of Trick Bag's Trap Doors, Painted Corners, Robert Moses' choreography with Terrence Marling and LaTanya Tigner at Dance Mission Theater this weekend and next. Information at robertmoseskin.org. Part of the beautiful orchestral introduction from the glorious Stabat Mater of Antonin Dvorak, a work completed in 1877 that Dvorak composed after he and his wife suffered the loss of one of their young children, three of them, within a very short span of time. It's being presented by the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra for three performances at Hertz Hall in Berklee, June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. The volunteer chorus will be joined by soloists soprano Ariana Strahl, mezzo Cara Cornell, bass Colin Ramsey, and tenor Brian Thorsett, who joins me in studio, along with conductor Ming Luke. Ming is the music director for the BCCO, only the third music director in its 50-year history. In past seasons, he has crisscrossed the globe working with various ensembles in addition to his duties with the San Francisco Ballet, for which he is primary guest conductor, and I think most recently seen in the pit conducting the Must-See Balanchine program, which we talked with him about a couple of months ago. Welcome to you, Ming.
Thank you.
Welcome back, I should say, and thanks for stopping by. Brian Thorsett is the tenor soloist, another one of those busiest guys in classical showbiz, though now teaching at Virginia Tech. He manages the Globe Hop as well, with frequent return visits here to the Bay Area, including our recent collaboration for Mark Blitzstein's Airborne Symphony, which we did with the Curious Flights Ensemble conducted by Alistair Neal. He was one of the soloists, me as narrator, the West Coast premiere of that. That was quite a concert, Brian. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome back, I should say. You're a graduate of the Marilla Opera Program, Glimmerglass's Young Opera American Artist Program, American Bach Soloists Academy, as well as the Bretton Peers Young Artist Program in England. A champion of new music, with a slew of premieres and commissions under his belt, and a second solo CD due out this year of the vocal works of Frank Tours, his first being the music of composer and friend David Conte. Well, gosh, nice to have you both here, and familiar faces as well for Open Air.
Thank you so much.
Well, this was initially composed, as I mentioned, as a reaction to the death of Dvorak's daughter, Josefa, and then after working on some other obligations, two of his other remaining children passed away. That's some heavy stuff, Ming. Have you looked into... You must hear this coming out in the music, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. The very first excerpt that you just played, in fact, you know, you can hear a single note for the first, you know, few seconds. And all it is that single note. You know, Bernstein had this great quote. He said that, you know, words lose meaning in context, but notes gain meaning in context. And so if you have, like, the word love, you know, it could be any type of love, you know, but the more adjectives, the more you describe it, the more specific the meaning is. And for music, it's almost exactly the opposite. You know, notes gain meaning in context. And you start off with that F sharp over and over and over again, and all you hear it is from... pinging between instruments in the orchestra, but that F sharp comes all the way to the end, and eventually, you know, this work was, as you mentioned, was written after great tragedy. Actually, he started working on it in 1875, but he had to stop because the pain was so much. But when he lost his two other children very quickly, 3 weeks apart, in 1877, then he, you know, with a lot of energy, you know, rushed to complete the work, and so. Over the course of the work, you can feel his pain, mm-hmm. and ultimately redemption. And so that F sharp actually comes back at the very end in a more triumphant manner, in a D major a rush of energy to the end.
Wow!
And so where that note had no context, it was just that single F sharp in the entire orchestra, you know, bouncing around the instruments. At the end, it actually becomes the moment of triumph at
wow.
the end.
Wow! Yeah. Getting goosebumps just thinking about that. I'm geeking out here with the theory end of things, but you know, I think listeners can really understand that how that context of how it transforms. Now, for those that aren't familiar with the Stabat Mater text, maybe you can bring us up to speed as how the text is derived. I believe it dates way back to the 1230s around there.
Yeah, 13th century. It's a poem about Mary's suffering upon seeing her son Jesus on the cross. And so, obviously, Dvorak had a lot to relate to it about the pain of seeing your child in pain or in death. And so, it's been set by many, many composers, but Dvorak wrote this very, very long. I think it's the longest Stabat Mater that exists today. And even the first movement, you know, you can tell that it's just a gargantuan work of great meaning to him. It's over 19 minutes long, just the first movement. Mm-hmm. And there are 10 movements to the work.
Wow.
And so it's quite an expansive work.
It does clock in at around 90 minutes and is the longest known setting of the Stabat Mater. Other composers... Settings included being set by Palestrina, by Vivaldi, both Scarlattis, Domenico and Alessandro, Pergolesi, Haydn, Rossini, Verdi, as well as Poulenc and Arvo Pärt all set this. Have either of you been involved in other settings of the Stabat Mater?
Yeah.
Brian Thorsett.
One of the unheralded ones is the Herbert Howells Stabat Mater, which is a phenomenal work for tenor soloist and organ solo and massive orchestra. And it's, again, a heartbreaking work. You know, and similar, Howells lost a child too and wrote the glorious Hymnus Paradisi, which is his reflection on the death of his son. And that's another piece of immense power. And a lot of that carries through his choral work and the, you know, some of the greatest music ever written. And his Stabat Mater is very late Howells, very disturbing melodically, and very dramatic and humongous tonal landscapes. And it's very expressionistic.
Mm-hmm. Where was that done?
That was in England. Mm-hmm. So that's, we generally don't do Howells here in America. For some reason, we've kind of cast him aside as, you know, the lazy stepchild of Vaughan Williams in Britain. But he's Hymnus Paradisi is the greatest English choral work ever written, in my very humble opinion. Sorry to all the Vaughan Williams fans out there.
And Ming? Other Stabat Mater.
What's the
plural of mater? Right? Mater. Anyway.
Yeah, the Pergolesi is obviously very, very famous. But, you know, I will put in a plug. There's a phenomenal website, stabatmater.info, and there's somebody that's actually been tracking every single Stabat Mater that has ever been written. And so you can explore, obviously, the Dvorak, but also all these other composers. You know, a fantastic, fantastic website.
Mm. So what are the difficulties of this piece when... from an orchestral viewpoint, first of all, it's a huge piece. Dvorak, of course, we know is this wonderful melodist, this wonderful folk elements and entering into it, I imagine.
Yeah, I think that it's the pacing that's the most difficult part, especially when you have a single movement that's 19 minutes long. That same music that opens the Stabat Mater ends with the 10th movement, starts off with that same, you know, searching and lost F sharp. But, you know, obviously this is not going to be like a typical mass that has a sanctus that's, you know, uplifting and triumphant and a gloria interchange with slower movements. But the entire sentiment of the Stabat Mater is about, you know, Mary's pain, and having that over the course of 90 minutes, I think it's about pacing and trying to make sure that it doesn't become, that there is enough variety and push and pull within the phrasings.
And how much rehearsal time do you get with the orchestra?
The orchestra functions like a typical orchestra. They'll rehearse the week of. Mm-hmm. And so they have a couple rehearsals by themselves, the one rehearsal with the chorus and soloists together, and then the dress rehearsal.
And let's talk about the chorus that's assembled. How many does the Berklee Community Chorus number at this point?
I think we're at 230 right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
But we talked about the difficulties orchestrally. Now, this is a volunteer and unauditioned chorus. So what are the difficulties in presenting and rehearsing such a crowd for such a major work?
I think the primary difficulty is that you have people of completely varying backgrounds. So if you've sung with San Francisco Symphony Chorus for 20 years, great, you're perfectly welcome in the chorus. If you've never sung before your entire life, you're also just as welcome. I think the idea is that each of us, you know, has we have artistic expression, we have an identity, and we don't judge that identity. It's about community coming together. But, you know, sheer numbers coming together, it allows us to be able to perform works like the Stabat Mater or the Britten War Requiem or these large works. You know, it's also interesting too because the Stabat Mater, it became very famous during Dvorak's time, and there were performances where they had 1,000 people performing. And so I think that having a very large chorus like this is fitting.
Mm-hmm. And these performances are at Hertz Hall on the UC Berklee campus, June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Brian, talk to me about the difficulties for the soloist then, or at least your end of the soloists.
Well,
tenor end.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I start on an F sharp and I end singing the final F sharp in this piece. You know, I'm the first soloist to enter, and given some of the more important solos, I shouldn't say that if the other soloists are listening, though. but as a father, and knowing what Dvorak went through when he was composing it, I find the very first vocal entrance exceedingly difficult to sing.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
Has this great weeping gesture coming down from the F sharp, as you heard in the violins playing in this introduction, and right before the chorus comes back in, the tenor has this C sharp to very exposed high A over a suspended chord, and it's this wailing gesture, that final spasm of grief when you see your child, you know, in the pain that you just want to take away from. I mean, like right now, it's hard to talk about it. It's a very powerful piece of music for a parent, knowing what the history of that piece is to perform. And it just, yeah, and pacing is a gigantic issue. You have a lot of movements. There's two solo quartets, the tenor has an aria, and there's Then the chorus joins in with the solos again in two more quartets, and there's a very extended duet for soprano and tenor. So at least for myself, it's a very difficult piece in terms of pacing, and especially emotionally pacing it, as well as the technical pacing of it.
Mm. Speaking of kids, how's your little daughter?
Doing great. She just turned four.
Four? My gosh.
Had her first haircut.
I remember when she was like, I remember the newborn shots.
Yeah. It's time flies. Oh, yeah.
Congratulations on that. And things are going well in Virginia for you?
They're going very well. You know, the luxury of having a teaching job is that it allows me to choose projects I'm really passionate about. And getting to work with people like Ming that I feel that I you know, can make my best musical self appear on stage. And so that's the gift of having that job, you know.
Mm. Well, the summer of 2017 rapidly approacheth. What does that mean for each of you artistically?
Lots of exciting stuff. I have, I'm doing this Stabat Mater. I have a world premiere on Friday of an oratorio written on the Barbara Allen folk song. I have a CD coming out of David Conti's two song cycles I premiered of David Conti's coming out in July. I have recitals in London and Paris and various other things I'm forgetting. Schubert recital in Mendocino. These are all local things, not to mention the things.
Right, right. Well, something tells me your daughter is eventually going to enjoy tagging along with you for those.
She sure is.
And Ming, who ping-pongs across the globe, I'm sure I failed to mention some of the other San Francisco Ballet performances that you conducted this season. I know you've been very busy on that front. What's the summer going to be bringing for you?
I'm heading out to Hawaii for an opera gala that's going to be in a few weeks, I guess. Obviously, BCCO's Stabat Mater. There's a large festival that I'm involved in managing, the Festival Napa Valley, which is an incredible lineup of musicians. But they're starting a collegiate program, and so managing that is going to take up quite a bit of time. So,
well, good luck with that. We'll have you again, I'm sure, to talk about the coming ballet season. Set up for us, if you will, the Quando Corpus Moriatur movement, the final movement of the Stabat Mater of Dvorak.
So the final movement is really sort of encapsulates the whole progression of the entire work, because as we mentioned, it starts off with that lost F sharp that starts the entire Stabat Mater. But instead, this time, after going through all those stages of grief and anger and pain, it transforms itself eventually towards the end, towards that more triumphant and almost, you know, fugal section that Dvorak, that propels itself to the end. It's a very, very powerful ending, and I think uplifting, especially because of Dvorak's own, you know, experiences.
Ming Luke, Brian Thorsett, thanks for coming in. We look forward to hearing this performance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
from the glorious Stabat Mater of Antonín Dvořák, to be heard performed by the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, conducted by Ming Luke with Brian Thorsett. Information at bcco.org. Also on the program, orchestrally, Beethoven's Egmont Overture. Good afternoon, David LaTulipe with you for Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. Coming up, pianist showman Frederick Hodges will be talking about his performances with the California Pops Orchestra, and our regular contributor Peter Robinson will share some details about some cultural happenings in the Bay Area. But right now, just taking a moment out of Open Air with our general manager Matt Martin to talk about public radio, culture, the arts, and support thereof. Hey, Matt.
Thank you, David. I wanted to share a note that just came in with a contribution from Edmund Nash in Piedmont, who's been supporting the station for many years. And Edmund made his contribution at KALW.org and left a note. He says, "Just thanks for excellent radio and a simple, honest attitude." Edmund, we take that as really high praise, that when we do come and talk to you and ask for your support for the station, that that's how it comes across, because it really is pretty straightforward what we do at KALW, and that is that we are listener-supported. 72% of our budget comes from the people who listen. Another chunk comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the rest from grants. That's how we make it work. And when we ask for your support just twice a year, we say, you do what you can. We don't tell you, here's the level to give at. We say, tell us what it's worth to you. Tell us how important you think it is to the community. And do what you can now. That's what we're asking you to do. Join Edmund. Join the many people who have supported this station today by making a call, 800-525-9917. Or if it's easier, it's in the afternoon, you're at your office, or maybe you're in the middle, whatever you're doing, go on your device, go on your computer, and make a contribution at KALW.org.
KALW.org is where Bob Aldra of San Francisco went and made a donation this hour. Thanks so much, Bob. As was Edmund Nash in Piedmont went to KALW.org. So we thank them for making that contribution during the segment. That's what's key. As you're hearing the programming that you've come to love and enjoy and find that makes a difference in your life, we hope that you make that phone call, 800-525-9917. As we wind up our spring membership campaign, only the second time during a year that we come and ask for your support and come to you uninterrupted, giving you the programming that you so value.
We are trying to wrap this up on Saturday morning to end it strong, to make it to our goal. We started with a goal of $400,000. We are under $130,000 to go. That's incredible progress, but we need a push right now. Your support can really, really help us out. Make sure we're within striking distance by Saturday morning. Make a contribution now at KALW.org or 800-525-9917.
We appreciate your support during this next segment of Open Air. Thanks. That's my next guest, Frederick Hodges, performing the music of birthday boy Irving Berlin, born this date in 1888, living to the ripe old age of 101. Oh, by the way, recent guest Hershey Felder just finished his one-man show, Irving Berlin, at Berklee Rep. Frederick is the special guest for the California Pops Best of the Pops season finale and variety show at the Flint Center in Cupertino on Sunday, May 21st at 3 p.m., led by conductor Kim Venas. Cal Pops has spent nearly three decades proving that orchestral performances by highly trained and talented musicians do not have to be stuffy affairs. No, people. The Pops Orchestra includes many of the Bay Area's leading musicians with training from very distinguished conservatories, including Oberlin, Juilliard, the Eastman School, as well as some of our distinguished West Coast centers of learning, and also includes talented musicians who just happen to also be scientists, educators, engineers, marketers, technology leaders, radio hosts, and other highly creative individuals. Pianist Frederick Hodges is sought after by today's foremost orchestras, festivals, conductors, and collaborative musicians. His artistry, virtuosity, and charm have brought him to the world's most prominent stages. In addition to his classical training and performing on piano, Frederick has established a reputation as a truly versatile artist, with repertoire from ragtime, stride, and novelty piano solos. Another forte is his live accompaniment to silent film, which he does regularly at the Niles S&A Silent Film Museum in Fremont. Pleased and proud to call him my friend as well. Frederick, what can I say? Welcome to our humble studios.
Thank you, Monsieur Latulippe. It's a delight to be here with you and your millions of devoted fans.
Well, how appropriate to be following the music of the great Bohemian Antonín Dvořák, music of another great Bohemian in spirit, Frederick Hodges.
Indeed. You know, when I was a child, I wrote a letter to Irving Berlin. He didn't respond, but I didn't take that as discouragement.
Well,
he's
I guess
still
not.
One of my favorite composers.
He must have been some sort of an influence. I want to talk to you about that. You know, you're a classically trained pianist. Is there a particular performer or performance that you recall that got you thinking outside the classical bubble?
I think it was hearing George Gershwin play the piano when I first heard his wonderful records that he made in the 1920s. They opened up a whole new world of possibilities of harmony and approach to popular music with the classical foundation.
And, well, you also have a doctorate in history from Oxford. Were you pursuing music at the same time, before or after? What? And why history at Oxford?
Well, why not? There's so many things you can study. You have to pick one. Though history is a fascinating thing, and especially since I'm, in terms of music, devoted to the music of the past, it's good to know about the environment in which music was composed. You can appreciate Gershwin without knowing anything about his life or the time in which he lived, but the music is so much richer if you know a little bit about it. And that goes for even Antonín Dvořák and Beethoven, Rachmaninoff.
So were you studying music at Oxford as well, or at least playing and performing?
Just performing, yes.
And I can't imagine that accompanying silent film is something you just pick up. Tell us, who was your role model for that, either present or past? And tell us a little bit about the technique involved in accompanying for silent film.
Well, it's a fascinating story. I didn't get into it because I wanted to. I got into it because I had founded the Film Society at Oxford University. And we were showing one day a wonderful movie called Pandora's Box, starring Louise Brooks. And the DVD that was provided to us, shockingly, had no soundtrack. And there I was in charge of this presentation, and there was no sound. Well, you can't have a silent movie without music.
Trial by fire, then, I guess.
And thankfully, there was a piano right in front of the stage. And so I, thinking I must save the show, ran down and just started noodling along. And so that was indeed the trial by fire.
Well, what have you learned since? I mean, I know that sometimes for silent films, you're given a theme or perhaps a popular tune that might have been popular at the time that works into the plot, but there's a lot of improvisation involved, isn't there?
There can be. I'm happy to accompany a movie never having seen it before, but I prefer to have studied it and to create an actual score. But the scores I create are the way scores were created back in the silent film era. For every scene, there is a particular emotion, particular mood, and so I find a piece of music that fits it exactly, and then I just weave those different pieces of music together as the scenes change.
Uh-huh. And do you incorporate some rather, I'm talking maybe some humorous gestures as well? If someone's having tea, do you go into tea for two, or do you strictly stick to the genre of the music of the film being presented?
Well, David, that is the genre. That is exactly what they would do. Uh-huh. So, for example, if there's a scene in which somebody starts peeling a banana, well, inevitably you are obliged to play Yes, We Have No Bananas.
Nice.
You know, the music keeps up a constant commentary, and yet we don't want to take the audience out of the movie experience. But should they be listening, we would like to, you know, induce a smile here or there.
So are there some new film discoveries that have been restored that you're looking forward to perhaps providing some music to? What's on the silent film project list for you these days?
Well, this very Saturday, I will be accompanying a movie, as you mentioned, at the Niles S&A Silent Film Museum in Fremont, or actually at Niles, Historic Niles. And that is a fantastic movie that has not been seen in years, called Clash of the Wolves, which stars the great artist Rin Tin Tin.
Nice.
And Rin Tin Tin movies are the finest movies made. They have the highest production values, wonderful scripts. They're thrilling, passionate, and the star is always a dog.
How can you go wrong
you
there?
You can't.
Do you know how many Rin Tin Tins there were? Or is there, do you know?
Like, well, throughout the 20s, there really was just one, and that's the original dog. But that dog was carefully bred to produce a line of Rin Tin Tins who kept the Rin Tin Tin series going until the 1950s.
Wow, that's something. Now, you're a regular returning guest artist with the California Pops Orchestra. What's your connection to them, and how did that first happen?
Well, it is such a pleasure to work under the baton of Maestro Vanas. He first met me, or shall I say, I met him back in the 1990s. In addition to founding the California Pops Orchestra, Kim also has something called the Black Tie Orchestra, which is a late 1930s dance band. And he hired me to play with it for many years. I also got my start playing with Don Neely's Royal Society Jazz Orchestra, which is a similar orchestra, though it has the instrumentation of the late 1920s and early 30s. So when Kim Vanas started having these wonderful California Pops concerts, he began inviting me to be a guest artist, and
fantastic.
The rest is history.
The rest is history, as they say. Once again, this performance is on Sunday, May 21st at 3 p.m. at the Flint Center. Now, improvisation is very much a part of your performance style, as it will be on Sunday, May 21st, when for a brief period you'll go off program, shall we say.
Well, I'll be doing a solo.
Is that a secret at this point? Or?
It's not a secret. It is scheduled.
All right.
What I'll be doing is playing a piano transcription that I will be creating on the spot of the original overture to the Gershwin show Lady Be Good.
Nice. That should be a lot of fun.
Yes. I love all the music from that show, and it's fun to weave it together and create a little overture.
This Best of the Pops concert will also feature new music from adventurous audience, including the premiere of 2016's Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them by film composer James Newton Howard, who composed music for Pretty Woman, The Fugitive, Batman Begins, and several others, including The Hunger Games. Also, a new symphony arrangement from the music from Broadway's smash hit, Hamilton. Should be a great concert on Sunday, May 21st, 3 p.m. at the Flint Center. Now, this season has been a very big one for California Pops. After many seasons of turning away patrons at the door, they're now going to be at the Flint Center in Cupertino. That's quite a house.
Absolutely, one of the largest houses in the Bay Area, but they're filling it, so if you would like to attend, I would suggest getting tickets now.
Indeed. You can go to calpops.org for more information and for the many things that Frederick Hodges is up to, frederickhodges.com. We're going to go out with your Manhattan Serenade from your CD of the same title, Manhattan Serenade, Piano Masterpieces of the Jazz Age. Frederick, thanks so much for coming in, and we look forward to another appearance here on Open Air when you can spare the time.
Thank you, David. It's been a great delight.
Indeed. And let's see. Pops conductor Kim Vanas is on record as saying Frederick Hodges is that rare combination of entertainer, musical scholar, technical master, and sly wit in one amazing package. I concur, Frederick. Best wishes for a splendid performance.
Thank you. Thank you.
The musical artistry of Frederick Hodges and the Manhattan Serenade. More about Frederick at frederickhodges.com. A pleasure to welcome Peter Robinson back this week for a discussion of the craft involved with bringing a work of literature to the stage or the screen. Peter, welcome back.
Yeah, hi, David. Good to be here. And I was just thinking, this year alone, I've seen at least six movies which all started their life as a novel. Hidden Figures by Margot Lee Shetley, 50 Shades of Dark by E.L. James, The Sense of Ending by Julian Barnes, more recently The Zookeeper's Wife by Diane Ackerman. And this week, playing across the Greater Bay Area, is The Circle, which is based on an original novel by David Eggers. And it's a very compelling story about a woman who gets a powerful tech company to employ her. This is The Circle, which maybe we should read Google. And it begins to uncover the secrets that deal with how we use technology and the boundaries between private and public, using the lead character's experience to explore where tech companies can go, and sometimes can they get too close for comfort. So The Circle is, I would call it, a gripping thriller. It's got the element of a horror story to it, and at the centre of the action is Emma Watson. People may remember her from Harry Potter. The key character, who is CEO of the company, is of course Tom Hanks, and we may remember him from Sully. And then from Star Wars, we have John Boyega. So it's a good cast. It's a fast-paced thriller, which I think gets the audience, and certainly the people around me when I saw it last night, to ask questions about how much of your own life would you like to have revealed? Do we have secrets? And one of the twists in the story, and it gets one of those almost TED-type productions, is when Emma Watson offers to wear a camera. So she will go through her life with a camera, recording everything around her, her parents, her friends, everything that happens at The Circle, and there will be no so-called hidden secrets. Today, one of the buzzwords, both in the security business and in government, is the word transparency. And do we really want to know all the inner workings of how we are? So that's the setup. And as the story progresses, we begin to see that this website they set up, which is called True You, becomes something of a haunting revelation. And we sit there spellbound, asking ourselves the question, what do we want to communicate? And of course, I was thinking of that song, May the Circle Be Unbroken, which indeed, without giving anything away, is the end of the story. But I was also flashing back to a movie from a few years ago, a totally different story, set in East Germany, called The Secret Lives, and Lives of Others was the actual title, the translation into English, where the Stasi, who were the East German secret police, got everybody to spy on each other. So even members of your family could turn you in for saying or doing something which may be considered unpatriotic. So I think this is a really gripping story. I think it's well adapted. It kept me on the edge of my seat, and it did make me ask real questions about what are my deepest secrets. And, of course, honor. I'm not about to reveal that now.
We'll wait for your memoir on that one, Peter.
Okay. Now, the second adaptation, I think, is equally interesting. It's the British playwright Alan Bennett, and he's one of my favourites. A couple of good movies I've seen in the past by him. One is called The History Boys, which had some good tunes apart from being a good story. And I first remember him in the 1960s as one of the four writers for a show called Beyond the Fringe, which was a deep satirical take on what essentially was the end of Macmillan's England, the end of the old England in the 1960s. And I think with this play, which is just opening, which is called Smut, S-M-U-T. And it's opening at Z-Space. It previews starting March the 10th, opens on May the 10th, opens on May the 13th. It is the story about a woman who's the central character who volunteers in her mid-50s to be a patient at a hospital for people to essentially diagnose. So she's an actor acting as the patient. And once again, I think Alan Bennett has got that knack of getting inside people's heads, people's minds. And he is a particularly good writer who writes dialogue the way it's spoken. So let me say a word about Word for Word, because Word for Word, I think, is a very special company unique to the Bay Area, where they take the script of a book, of a story, of a novel, of a novella, and they actually present it, as the title suggests, word for word. So if the text said he spoke quietly, they'd use quietly. They'd use the adverb. And they're a small company, so there's a lot of intimacy at Z-Space. You feel you're only a few feet away from the stage. You're totally engrossed in the story. And if nothing else, Alan Bennett is a great storyteller. I mentioned the History Boys. More recently, we've had Maggie Smith playing in The Lady in the Van. And I think what his background is a social take on hypocrisy, what people think they are, what they pretend they are, and then the ultimate question, what they really are. So these are two really interesting plays. One is a film opening and around the Greater Bay Area. It's called The Circle. If you work at Google, you may want to do a second take and consider what do you really know about your friends. Or if you're into intimate theatre, where acting, the spoken word, understanding the text, portraying the text, and bringing the text to life, then I highly recommend a trip down to Z-Space. The play is called Smut, and the company Word for Word.
Thanks, Peter. We'll look forward to that. And Word for Word is a good friend of Open Air that we've been on before. We hope to have them on again.
Good to be here, David. Thank you.
And that's Open Air for this Thursday, May 11th. Thanks so much for being with us. A reminder that our shows are archived at klw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. If you've got a segment selection by a suggestion, by all means, dash me an email, david@klw.org.